Well, we're going to press on in the book of Numbers. So we only have a few more chapters left. So we're in chapter 32. I've got a handout that I'll split between you and I don't know if somebody else. Okay. So yeah, handout's coming around, and so yeah, we're reaching the end. 36 chapters in the book. So we're nearing the close here. Couldn't tell if I heard like a collective sigh or not, but you know it's a big book. It's what has been your your thought on the book so far? I know we'll do a little debrief towards the end, but I'm just curious. Being in the book of Numbers for as long as we have, what's something that has surprised you about the book? What's something that you've learned about it so far? Like, I know not all of you have been in here for the whole study, but just, you know, something that surprised you about the book of Numbers, and something that or something that you've learned that the book has taught you. Anybody have any? Yeah, Lauren.
I'd say slow to learn.
Slow to learn. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Slow to learn, and it's if we point our finger at the Israelites, we've got three more pointing back at us, right? So you were going to say. Sure. Sure. Yeah, so much of the when we get, especially when we get into the legal parts, you know, it seems like this is does not pertain to me. And so that's where taking a moment and just figuring out what's the principle behind this thing usually can open our eyes to a little bit. Heather? Yeah. Yeah. Yep. No, that's so true. Like that, I think we often forget that God is the main character of His book, and so as we can kind of read these narratives and see the human characters, and we forget that there is a divine character, and He's always consistent. He never changes. He's always faithful. He is the standard. He sets the standard for what faithfulness is and what righteousness is. And so it's just, it's good to see His constancy in the midst of the ups and downs of His people. And I think more than anything, as you know, obviously there's judgments that occur, whatever, but how patient He is with just all the obstinate rebellions and complaints and all of this stuff. And yes, there's consequences that He brings to His people, but He's so patient. It could have been so much worse for them, right? But it wasn't. I mean, and the fact that He let their children go in, he's setting their children up to take the land that they basically forfeited by unbelief. But He didn't have to do that either, right? So, yeah, just a lot of things that we're learning. One other question I have, and this relates to the chapter that we're in, chapter 32, and that's this. The idea of unity. Why is unity important? Or to put it on the flip side, why is disunity an issue in God's people? Why do we have to be careful of disunity?
Well,
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so you could say disunity is a foothold that Satan has. You don't want to give opportunity. So that's an argument for why you want to be careful of disunity. On the flip side, looking at the positive aspect of it, not of disunity but of unity, why is unity important then? Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so there's something that's not reflective of God's character in disunity. I don't know if that where you're going, or yeah.
That makes sense.
Right.
Obviously there's decisions of being on what color to paint the walls on a church, maybe not so
blue. No, oh sorry. No.
Then I there's clearly something out of line.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. No, that's James 4, right? Like, why are there fights and quarrels among you? Because everybody is after what they want, right? And so there's this kind of self-focused attitude, and when self-focus occurs, then there's all these fights. There isn't an ability to be one. And I, going back to what Jeremiah said, like, I think if we want to go one layer deeper, that disunity is reflective it's not reflective of the character of God, but it's also not even reflective of the essence of God. God is a triune God, always in unity, right? And so whenever God's people are divided and arguing and not aligned with each other, not in unity, God's people are not reflecting the very nature of God as a triune God. That Trinity, the idea of three in one, it's the essence of who God is a unit. Or a unity, where they're never divided, they're always together, always united, and so there's just an essence part that isn't reflective of the person of God, and so that's important. And I think even going back to what you said with the house divided, think about the mission of the church. How difficult is it for the church and for God's people to be on mission and yet divided amongst themselves? I mean, you can't accomplish anything. You've been in, if you've been in military, like imagine a sharp division in a military unit where they have a mission, they have an objective, they have to accomplish this objective. But there is sharp disagreement between the members of that unit. And how can they ever accomplish the mission if they can't work as a team, if they can't work as a unit, right? So there's splash effects to disunity. It's the reason here at the church, because we have a Christian school, so we've got, maybe 17 or 18 employees that are on staff at the church, and then you have, 60, 70 people who, between administration and teachers who are at the school. And so when you have all these people, and then you have 500 students who are here every day, and just on, off, everything's going, it's just this bustling. I mean, man, it's so quiet in the summertime, and I get so much work done. And then school starts up and it's, whoa. And we every single week, we have a meeting between the church staff and the school staff every Tuesday morning at 8:30, where we do devotions together. We talk about what the week's going to look like. You know, this room is going to be used here, you know, any questions. Let's diffuse any potential disunifying elements. Let's always be in communication with other. Let's be transparent when problems are happening, and let's work on it, because guaranteed, if you have an organization this big with a bunch of sinners in the same room who all want different things, right? And you're going to have disunity, and there's going to be things that you have to work on, and if you let them fester, they will explode your organization. You will not be able to function. You will be having to fix, rather than being on. So we're very proactive here to make sure there's unity so that we're all on mission together. And I think the church needs to be the same way. I think that's the reason why, not the reason why, but one of the benefits of regular life, you know, involvement in the local church, why you shouldn't, you know, forsake the assembly, is because when you're always with the church, when you're always with brothers and sisters in Christ, you soften your heart towards people. You stop being so much like, this is what I want, and you're everybody is kind of giving, and everybody's taking, and everybody's serving, and you soften, and you're on mission together. And I bring this up because chapter 34, at its surface, is about the dividing of some of the land that is across the Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan, because remember, they haven't crossed over yet. That's not until Joshua. The time of Joshua, Moses is gone. They cross over, and they take Jericho. But there's a few tribes that wanted to settle on the east side of the Jordan, what we're going to call the Trans-Jordan. That's kind of the term that's used in biblical geography to talk about the land east of the Jordan, Trans-Jordan. And they wanted to settle there. Okay, so by the end of the chapter, land is divided. You've got Reuben and you've got Gad, and you've got part of the tribe, the half-tribe of Manasseh, who have land allotments east of the Jordan. And on the surface, it's what the chapter is about, but it's not really. That's the end point. That's where everybody kind of finally got to a point where they were unified in this. But the beginning point is, and the travel, the traversing to get there, is quite the drama. This is one of the few chapters where it doesn't open up with, and then God spoke to Moses saying, this isn't a chapter that's initiated with divine revelation. This is a chapter actually that's initiated with a problem that opens the drama up. And you kind of see that in the beginning of chapter 32, verse 1. Now the people of Reuben and the people of Gad had a very great number of livestock. And the words that are used here, it kind of doesn't do it justice, the amount of emphasis. It's just like they had the Reubenites and the Gadites had a lot of livestock, a great number, or a multitude, a numerous multitude, or something like that. It's there's like this overemphasis in the text just to make the point. They're like drowning in livestock. It's probably based on some of the spoils that they got when they took Og of Bashan and Sihon the Amorite king, you know, earlier in the Numbers, and then they had lots of livestock spoils from when they attacked Midian, and so they've got all this livestock, and these two tribes in particular had a plethora. I don't know. They had a lot of livestock. I mean, it's kind of hard to put into words how the text kind of emphasizes this. A very great number, it says, of livestock. And livestock can be anything. It's not, this isn't just sheep. This isn't any kind of livestock animal, from sheep and goats and cattle, all of that. And so there is a need that they have, and they have a potential solution. They saw, it says, the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, and behold, the place was a place for livestock. So they're looking around at where they're at. They're on the plains of Moab. They're camped out over there, and they're looking around. They've engaged in military engagements just north of here, and all the way up. And so they're looking around, going, "This place would be perfect for us. It's wide open. There's lots of pasture land for cattle to graze on. It gets lots of rainfall." And in this particular part, because if you don't know about the geography of Israel, the topography of the land is such that it is one of the most varied places in terms of climate, in terms of temperature, in terms of precipitation, one of the most varied places on earth. Of such a variety of different kind of weather and different kind of precipitation patterns, just because of how close it is to the Mediterranean, and how close it is to the desert. It's just this little land bridge, and so you know you'll have wet winds that sweep in from the west, and they're moist, and as they move in, and the land. Starts to climb upwards to 2,000 feet in elevation, coming from sea level all the way up to where you hit the Rift Valley, and you go down into the Jordan Rift Valley, and all of that collects, and that precipitation ends up being dumped on the western slopes of those mountains. They're very lush, and then you have basically a rain shadow on the other side that all of the eastern parts are just dry and arid, and then it kind of collects again as it goes up to the other side. And so you have lots of variety. Sometimes wind will sweep in from the east, and when that does, it's a hot, scorching east wind that's coming out from the desert, very dry. It just desiccates the land. I mean, there's just all sorts. You can have rain in some places up to 26 inches a year of rain. There is at times, snow is rare, but it's not uncommon. And in fact, there's times where some of the mountain passes are closed in the winter, even today, because they have too much snow to travel through. So it's an amazing place, lots of variety. And they're looking at this place and they're going, "This is perfect for us. This is all the land that we need in order to accommodate the amount of cattle that we have accumulated and the amount of livestock that we've accumulated in all of this." And so they make a request. And the request, verse 2, "The people of Gad, the people of Reuben, came and said to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and to the chiefs of the congregation." So this isn't just them kind of taking Moses aside going, "Hey, you know, can you do us a favor?" They're trying to make this official. They have Moses there. They have the high priest, who's the religious, the spiritual leader, who's going to be taking over that aspect of life in Israel from Moses once he's died. You have the kind of the tribal chiefs who are there. So you have all these people. They're making their proposal, and he said they said to them, "Ataroth, Dibon, Yazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eliela, Sibon, Nebo, and Beon." See, these are all cities. "The land that Yahweh struck down before the congregation of Israel is a land for livestock, and your servants have livestock." So once again, it's just like this. You know, how many times are we going to hit this just to make the point? We've got a lot of livestock. We are teeming in it. We are teeming in it. So verse 5, "And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan." And so on the surface, they're making a very polite request. They draw near. They entreat politely. "If we have found favor," you know, you kind of look at the past actions. We've been engaged in this combat. This is spoils of war. The Lord obviously has been good to us. He's blessed us with all of this stuff. So, but and so we're asking if we could find favor in your sight, that you would allow us to have this land instead of land across the Jordan. Okay? Now, just think practically for a moment here. How does that request sound to you? Just any like anything that's kind of sits in your stomach that goes, yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah. Okay, we need the troops. Yeah, what? Okay, so when you say, don't take us across the Jordan, what are you saying? Right? Yeah, we're about to go across the Jordan and engage in mortal combat with Canaanites. And, we don't want to do it with an arm tied behind our back. Okay? So there's a practical, question of limitation. And honestly, there's a couple of ways that commentators have taken this whole chapter and understood like what's going on. Because there's kind of, not to divide, but there has been like this division in a bad sense about just the way that people have understood who is in the wrong here. And so there's some people who kind of look at this request and say, this is a completely reasonable request. And then when we read Moses' reaction, they basically say, Moses so overreacted here that he read into things. He just doubles down and he just like basically calls them a brood of sinners for even asking this. And so, and after they clarify it, there's clarifications that happen. But it's like, okay, so maybe Moses is wrong here, and maybe this really is an honest request. There's no ill intention. There's no ulterior motive. They have presented everything. They've come up. They haven't demanded everything. They're just asking for the large herds and flocks and livestock that they have. They're asking for an accommodation. Okay, that's one way to kind of that it's been read. The other way is that, yes, some have actually said, like, no, there actually was an ulterior motivation. I don't think so. But I think there are some that said, Moses was harsh in this, as we're about to see, but he has a point. And there's something to the fact that you have two tribes who have already asked for land that is outside the borders of the land of promise. And it's almost like they've seen this land. They says, this is beautiful. Let's just settle here and be done with it. It's like they've settled early. Like they haven't finished, right? And they haven't gone in and finished the job and actually seen the land flowing with milk and honey that God had said he promised all the way back to their forefathers. And so that's another way. And it is important to remember that this is not part of the land. We're about in chapter 34, we're going to see the boundaries of the land marked out very, very specifically, and the Transjordan is not included in it. So you've got two tribes, we're going to find out that Manasseh kind of tag-teamed onto this, but they're just not mentioned. Two tribes that are going, I think we're good here. And when you think about it that way, it's like, okay, maybe there is something here. Maybe it's not about their motivation. Maybe it's about their lack of motivation. Maybe their immediate need was outweighing the weight of the promise that God had given, where they're just like maybe holding light the promise of God in the land. And so we don't even need to see the land. We're sure this land is better for us than whatever is over there. It's kind of like saying, I'm sure this life is better than whatever life God has for me in the future. So I'm going to invest now. Who knows? But that begins this drama of chapter 32, where there is a back and forth, and Moses gets on their case. I do want to read what Gordon Wenham said, just because he does kind of bring this out. He says, to appreciate the significance of this episode, it should be noted that Transjordan lay outside Canaan, the land promised to the fathers. Its boundaries are defined in chapter 34, where it is clear that from the Sea of Galilee southwards, the Jordan marks the eastern frontier of Canaan. That any Israelite tribe should consider settling outside the land promised to Abraham showed a disturbing indifference to the divine word. The word on which Israel's existence entirely depended. The nation stood poised to cross the Jordan and take up its inheritance when suddenly three of the tribes announced their intention of opting out. It looked like the spy story all over again. And that's exactly where Moses is going to go to. So you have that set in your mind, and I think that you can understand why the events of chapter 32 unfold. Was it an innocent request? Probably. But just because we have something that we ask in innocence doesn't necessarily mean that it's always the right request. Okay? We can ask something without an ulterior motive, but there's stuff that sometimes goes on in our hearts that we're just not even aware of. And that's what I think Moses' concern was as he begins to respond to them with what turns out to be a particularly harsh response. He's going to see in verse 6. In the waning years of his life, how would you feel about that?
I'm tired of watering for
40
years
in the desert. Yeah. Oh, man, this is a very harsh response. You hear his words. He calls them a brood of sinners. He calls them, you were just like your fathers, right? And kind of going back to what Lauren said of kind of the meta theme of Numbers, one of them being, you know, just a failure to learn from the past, a failure to change and be different than the generation that's come before is one of this question. Is the second generation, are the kids of the ones who died in the wilderness, are they going to do any better? And I'm sure you can kind of understand why Moses is looking at it going, oh no, this is the same thing all over again. Okay, so I'm going to let you in on a little on the inner staff dynamic of Anchorage Grace Church, right? Because we have Jeff Kratz as a senior pastor. We've got four associate pastors, and we talk about things. We talk about what's going on, shepherding issues or whatever, stuff like with the church and the school or in the school or in the church or whatever could be a disunifying issue or something like that, where there's some and you know, there's this phrase that Jeff has used so many times that I can't hear it now without kind of having a little smile on my face just because I've heard it so many times. He says, I've seen this movie before. And what he's talking about, he's talking about 10 years of pastoral ministry as an associate pastor, children's pastor in Little Rock, Arkansas, before he ever came up here. And now he's working on year 18. Of senior pastor. So you've got 28 years of pastoral ministry experience and just this one man alone, and he has seen a lot. So he's seen basically every kind of scenario that you can think of. You just put a new face and a new name to the scenario, to the people, and I've seen this movie before. I know why people do what they do because I've seen it happen before. And you learn that. You learn that not even just in pastoral ministry. You learn that in just life. You know, you get burned once by something or someone or whatever, and then it's like, I've seen this movie before. Here's a new person asking me the same kind of thing. I remember early on, I came here and I was invited to dinner over at some people's house, and you know, Natasha and I were brand new, and the dinner was nice, but then it turned into we want to join forces with you to basically take over X, Y, and Z ministry. And I was like, oh, this is why I'm here. I'm not here to have dinner and to be like to just be welcome to the church is you're here because you have an agenda and you want to get somebody in power to help you accomplish what you want in the church. And so that's one of those moments where it's like, okay, I didn't go with it, but I see it. And it's like, okay, I'm going to learn from this. When somebody asks me and my wife to go to dinner, I'm not going to like assume motivations, but I'm not just going to go in naively anymore because I don't know what people want. And whenever you're in a position where you do have authority and you do have you never know what people want. And so I do, you know, I try to give the benefit of the doubt, but I do go in eyes wide open because I've seen that movie before, and Moses had too. Moses had seen that movie. And I'm not saying that everybody has an agenda. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying I've seen that movie before. And so I'm always just kind of eyes wide open of what's going on here. And 99% of the time, it's nothing. There's nothing. There's no motivation. But sometimes you just never know. You never know why somebody might be trying to do something. And Moses, I think, is acting this way because he brings up two primary concerns. In verse 6, he says, if you stay here and you just, don't take us across the Jordan. Heather brought it up. We're going to be fighting the Canaanites without an arm, right? We need your troops. And are you just going to abandon them and say, well, we have our land. You know, good luck. Good luck taking the rest yourself. It's not our problem anymore, okay? So that's one thing he brings up, that there's a potential for disunity if they're unwilling to join the other tribes in the conquest. Then that's disunifying. That's an issue. And then in verse 7, he brings up another thing. Why will you discourage the heart of the people? This has a potential to discourage people. And I think in a couple of ways. Number one, if they think you're afraid to go across, you're going to do just like the spies did. And you're going to discourage them, and you're going to make them doubt whether or not God is powerful enough to lead them and give them victory. And that's exactly what the spies said. It's a great land, they said, and it's filled with giants, and we can't take it. And why have you brought us out here to die in the wilderness and to have our kids die? So you're going to discourage them even just by saying, like, we're not going because we have our land, and now they're going to just go, we can't take this, and we have a potential mutiny on our hands again. Issue. But I think there's another issue, too. You could discourage them in terms of, you know, not believing God. You can also discourage them with the same kind of feeling of settledness. Well, yeah, this land is pretty good out here. Maybe I don't want the land across the Jordan either. Maybe this is good enough. Maybe this is what I need. Maybe I'm not interested in going across and seeing what God has for me. There's lots of ways you can discourage people, and this is his core concern that he brings it up, and then he ties it back to what he has seen. He has seen this movie before, and he goes into a lot of detail. In fact, there's a lot of verbal links that I just listed here. This is from a lot of commentators, but this is just from Cole's commentary. But just see the links between chapters 1 or 11 through 14, where all of these, you know, these rebellions happen that escalate in refusing to take the land in chapter 13 and 14. And then here, I mean, you have all of these verbal links that I think Moses, and how he's constructed this, is tying it back, going, this, all of this was a potential of this next generation going, we've not learned from the past. And so he rehearses it. I mean, you heard it. He went into detail about what was going on, and you know, when he's doing this, he's using history. He's kind of constructing, and I like what one writer said. Moses presents an example of a biblical use of history for the instruction of the people of God. He speaks with specificity, passion, and historical insight with a contemporary feel, the tying of the experience of the past into the present of his audience. In some ways, this section may be thought of as a model of biblical exhortation. He is basically going, guys, we were all there. You saw what your fathers did. You saw what happened with the spies. Don't make the same mistake. Don't walk in their footsteps. He's trying to get them to learn from history. And it's a really important lesson that we need to learn too. I think too often we're ignorant of history. History in general, biblical history in particular, church history also. That there's so much that is considered new today, theologically, that is not new. It's the regurgitation of old heresies, just dressed in different jeans. Like, it's the same old heresies that were back in the first and second centuries. Arianism, all this stuff that it's just now we call it something else, or we don't know what to call it because it's so new. But as soon as you look at it, go, the church has dealt with this, but the church doesn't know it's dealt with this because we've basically are kind of ignorant of what has happened in the past. So that's just an important call for us as a church to just kind of be aware of where we come from, where we've learned. Take a church history course or read a book on historical theology and how theology have developed over the centuries, how we've come to unify around the core doctrines of the Christian faith. When we're talking about the core doctrine, we're talking about the person of Christ, the Trinity, the gospel. I mean, I think of all of those, we probably know church history the best when it comes to the Reformation, where we were clarifying the gospel in terms of salvation by grace through faith, apart from works. And there was clarity, and we're probably the most familiar of that. You go back all the way before, there was questions on the nature of God as a Trinity and how that relationship is. There was questions on the person of Christ and how are we supposed to understand him being human and divine and how does all of that work. And say all of these are important aspects of Christian theology that have been dealt with, have been thought through, wrestled through, and the church has come out with a clear understanding of who Christ is and how to articulate it. So you just have to go back and you have to learn from it so we don't repeat the same mistakes or get caught up in the same kinds of falsehoods that the church has already dealt with. But I do have a question. Do you think that Moses overreacted? Knowing what you do about their request, about their motivation, what do you make of Moses' response? Did he overreact? Was he too harsh? Was there anything that he could have taken back? Is there anything that he did wrong? Or was he just completely in the right? What do you think? Yeah. Right. Sure. Yeah. Yep. Right. Right.
Yeah. This needs to happen.
Yep. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Definitely was not diplomatic. That's very true. Yeah. Yep. Right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very simple-minded, and I see this in this simple metaphor. I mean, we look to you as a leader in the church, and you have this knowledge and relationship with God that we trust. And I see this parallel between them, and they come to him asking for this favor. And if this, forgive me for this, there's three doors. We're going to show you door number one. Promise us, because you know this wisdom, what's on door number three is God's promise. And your promise, he's promising us, it is his promise to us, and it's his glory for us. But we want the Vespa, right? That's in door number two, because, oh, it's a promise. This is what we've got. It's nice. It's what we know. And it's our lack of faith that he sees as the leader. And we get to see the humanness come out into his
sure. Letter. Yeah, that's a great articulation of, and I like what you said, the humanness of this all. We have seen Moses who throughout his depiction throughout the Pentateuch, he has seemed like he's one of those characters that's static, that doesn't change, that always does the right thing, that always speaks for God, until he himself rebels and is just like the people, right? And is living with the consequences of knowing he will die on this side of the Jordan, and he will not cross over with them. And so I'm sure that he carries with him the sense of regret, a sense of sadness that can color what he said. Like, he is not a perfect person. And these narratives are not given in order to paint anyone as perfect, or just like, no, like he did all the right things here. And so I think that the humanness is coming out, but I love what you're saying of like, he's seeing the heart, and at the heart of this, you're settling for what you know, instead of moving out in faith. And that's what he's responding to, because that's what the people were doing in the past. But I think also you could say, like, I think he did assume some false motivations, like, and we don't want to go across. We're not willing to go across. We're afraid to go across. And so he's bringing all this up and maybe is coming to some conclusions that are not correct. But this is where we kind of enter into this negotiation where the Reubenites, verse 16, they're basically going, let me allay your fears of what you think is going on here. They came near to him, so they're entreating him. They're being, you know, subservient to him. And we're saying, you know, we'll build sheepfolds for our livestock, cities for our little ones, but we will take up arms, ready to go before the people of Israel until we've brought them to their place, and our little ones shall live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until each of the people of Israel has gained his inheritance, for we will not inherit the land with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has come to us on this side of the Jordan to the east. So this is their proposal. Okay, let me allay your fears. We have no intention of sitting this out. All we're asking, let's just, can we make sure our flocks and make sure our kids and our wives are secure, and then we will happily go across. In fact, he says, before the people of Israel, we will lead the way. We will be the storm troops and go in front and lead the way. If that's because we're not asking to opt out of this. We're all in. We're all in. And Moses basically accepts their proposal, but he does it in a very, very formal way. He actually uses the language of covenant and basically says, okay, we're going to cut a covenant right here. He says, verse 20, so Moses said to them, if you will do this, this is the if-then of a covenant, if you will do this, if you will take up arms to go before Yahweh for the war, and every armed man of you will pass over the Jordan before Yahweh until he has driven out his enemies from before him and the land is subdued before Yahweh. Then, here's the consequences. If you're faithful, then after that, you shall return and be free of obligation to Yahweh and to Israel, and this land shall be your possession before Yahweh. In other words, he's saying, okay, here's my proposal. If you do what you say you will do, yes, you can have the land. This is it sounds so much like my kids ask me, like, can we do this? I'm like, if you do this, then you can have what you want. If you don't do this, there are consequences. And that's exactly what he says. It's very, very parent-like, but it's also very covenant-like. This is an example of a covenant. It's not covenant it's not used there, but this is covenant language between two groups of people. But if you will not do so, verse 23, behold, you have sinned against Yahweh, and be sure your sin will find you out. In other words, there are consequences. You can't outrun your sin. You can't outrun it. I like what R.K. Harrison said. You be sure your sin will find you out has long passed into the realm of proverbial speech. The retributive effect of sin tends to have a cumulative force. Those who sow the wind will reap the whirlwind. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Covenant fidelity is demanded of those living under the new covenant as it was of the old. Your sin will find you out. You can't outrun that. And so he says, verse 24, build cities for your little ones, folds for your sheep, do what you've promised. And the people of Gad and the people of Reuben said, your servants will do as my Lord commands. Our little ones, our wives, livestock, all the cattle remain here in the cities of Gilead. Your servants will pass over every man who is armed for war before Yahweh to battle as my Lord orders. They're going to do what he says. So handshake time. And now Moses is going to take it one step further and make it formal. He's going to gather Joshua, he's going to gather Eleazar, the high priest, gather, and he's going to make them swear it publicly so that everybody's aware. So it's not just a backdoor deal in the back room where they're shaking hands and then everybody's like, how did you get that land? It's they're making a formal pledge. We are pledging to go across with you in order to get this land. And they do that. Moses gave the command concerning them to Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, verse 28, the heads of the fathers' houses. He said to them, if the people of Gad and the people of Reuben, every man who is armed to battle before Yahweh will pass with you over the Jordan, and the land shall be subdued before you, then you shall give them the land of Gilead for a possession. However, if they will not pass over with you armed, they shall have possession among you in the land of King. Basically, they forfeit this land that they want, and they're going to have to come over. If they're not willing to come over and help you, then they're all going to have to come over, and we're going to divide the land like that we would have had they not asked us in the first place. And they make it formal. So verse 31, the people of Gad, the people of Reuben answered, what the Lord has said to your servants, we will do. We'll pass over armed. The possession of our inheritance shall remain with us beyond the Jordan. So this is formal. They have now not, it's not just a handshake anymore. They've signed on the dotted line. Everybody understands. And this is going to be important because what ends up happening here, and I think one of the things that Moses is concerned about, is that geography divides. Geography divides. We understand this. How does it feel to be an Alaskan or to be a Hawaiian and to belong to the 50 states and yet be part of the uncontiguous 50 states? It's different, right? There is a feel. You feel isolated up here. You feel isolated when you're in on a lone Pacific island. As many people as are on that, you feel alone. You feel isolated. You want to know, like, okay, 48, do you have our backs, right? We're closer to Russia than anyone else is. We can see it from our house. So, like, are you going to have our backs? Will you even ship to us? Right. We pump your oil. Can we get another refinery? Can you let us pump the oil that's in here? Like, all of that. Like, all of that is the feeling of what geography does. And Moses knows that. And he knows that, especially in a day where, you know, there's no bridges or anything, the Jordan, especially in flood season, can be a mile wide. Okay, so you just can't just cross it anytime you want. You got to wait until the right season to be able to cross safely and to ford. And so this is a formidable obstacle that can have divisive consequences for the people. And it did. It did. You look throughout Israel's history and the people, there is a distancing of the three tribes that settled on the Transjordan. It did have consequences throughout their history. In fact, there was another episode right at the end of Joshua where all the conquest happens because Gad and Reuben do it. They send 40,000 troops over, and they take and conquer, and then when they're coming back, they're like, we don't want to be forgotten by these. They're just like, we're Alaska, we're Hawaii, we don't want to be forgotten. Let's build an altar as a memorial altar to just whenever anybody looks at that, we're going to all remember we've got brothers and sisters on the other side of this river that we don't want to forget. And then what happened? Do you remember what this story? It just blew up. And all of a sudden, you know, Joshua's like, there's an altar. They've gone pagan. Everybody grab your guns and like, let's kill them. They've turned away from the Lord. Like, oh my goodness, what? We just didn't want to be forgotten. Like, talk about misreading intentions. And then they figured it out. They clarified the matter and all was good. But man, there was a lot of misreading of intentions. I think Moses did some of that here too. He didn't ask a question. He jumped to a conclusion about their motivations. You don't want to go to war and you don't care about your fellow tribes and their desires and their feebleness of their hearts. You don't care about that. I think he jumped to some conclusions there, but at the same time, he wasn't wrong about the tendency of the human heart. And so I think as we're getting to the end there, because by the time you get to the end of the chapter, everything is divided. We learn that Manasseh is included in this. You can kind of see the map and how it gets divided at the end and where they end up. But the applications for us, obviously disunity is a cancer. It's malignant. If it's unaddressed, if it's not rooted out and destroyed and extricated from the body, it will spread, it will metastasize, and it will kill the body. So so whether or not it's disunity in your home between you and your wife or you and your kids or whatever, or it's in the church or it's in we have to deal with the issue of disunity. This is Paul's immediate emphasis in Ephesians 4, that because Christ unified us by making the two one in his own body, you have to fight for unity. You don't create unity. God created unity. But you maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bonds of peace by all the things that he talks about in the first three verses, all of these, like, these attitudes of humility and patience and forbearance and dealing with each other in kindness and gentleness, all of those things, that throws water onto the fire of disunity and just puts it out before it has a chance to spread. But if you try to just kind of squirt it with a squirt gun, or you feel like you just kind of continue to feed it in your heart, it will grow and it will be much, much harder to mend, to deal with this disunity now. Okay? Because a divided house can't stand. Okay? And it can't accomplish the mission, and it doesn't glorify God. The other one would be to just make sure that you don't jump to premature conclusions. Just make sure that you're asking questions. I mean, this is just the basics of dealing with people. I mean, you can go to Proverbs 18:13 or Proverbs 17:27, just asking, you know, everybody thinks that they know the what's going on until you've heard the other side. And so I think in instances like this, where there's a lack of clarity, what can you do in the immediate rather than jumping to a conclusion that you know what their motivation is and you know it's sinful? Like, what can you do? Talk to them, but ask questions. Questions that will draw out a person's heart. Patiently, gently, pastorally, ask the way that you, I have been wrong about my kids' motivations, where they've asked for something and I've shot them down and I've been harsh with them because I assumed that I knew what they were asking and why they were asking it, when in fact it's not why, and it was not what they intended, and I had to come clean. I had to ask their forgiveness because I was not patient in the moment. So it's just those kinds of, this is how disunity can also erupt. And so just be careful about drawing conclusions, about assuming motivations in people. I don't like it when I ask something and my motivation is misunderstood, or it's prescribed, a motivation I never had for why I asked is prescribed to me. And that goes against the way that I've taught even hermeneutics, right? Hermeneutics is about understanding what the author intended, not about what I think he intended. So I want to get to, what did the author intend? And I would love to have the same treatment done to me when I say something. I want them to know, what did I mean by that? Not, what do they think I meant by that? Okay? And we should do the same thing with other people. And then third, learn from the past. Learn from past mistakes, from your own past mistakes. Learn from others. This is 1 Corinthians 10. These things were written down for our instructions so that we would not fall into the same traps as ancient Israel did, as our forefathers did, as maybe our own parents did. Learn from it. Grow out of the past, and let's avoid walking in the same footsteps and making the same mistakes as people that come before us. Any thoughts or questions or anything that's kind of hits you from Numbers 32 as we close? Yeah, no, he's not in there. Yep, absolutely. Any other thoughts or questions, comments, devotional insights? All right, let me pray. Thank you, Lord, for just the very human chapter where we can see ourselves in the place of Moses. We can see ourselves in the place of the Reubenites and the Gadites. And we just want to be humble, Lord, and not point too many fingers in too many directions that we end up boxing ourselves into a corner, and exposing our own our own tendencies and our own faults, Lord, but help us to be people that fight for unity, that desire it, not because we're going to create a false sense of peace, but we want true peace. We want a Holy Spirit peace that comes from maintaining the unity that you've created in Christ, where we're all brought together in the gospel around the person of Jesus Christ, and he is our peace. So, Lord, help us to just be humble every day as we just interact with each other, to not jump to conclusions about motivations, and to be patient with each other, to be long-suffering, to be willing to put our own desires in the back, and to honor other people as more important than ourselves. It's what Christ did as an example to us, Philippians 2. He humbled himself, and help us to just follow in his footsteps and to have that same mind as was in Christ Jesus. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.